thank you all for giving me an hour of your afternoon. I'll try to make it worth your while. And if I start using vocabulary or concepts that you're not familiar with and you start thinking you're going to lose your way, please stop me and say, I don't understand that. And I'll try to do my best to give you an English translation of it instead of this philosophy stuff that I'll be talking for most of the hour anyway. Maybe I should say just a word about myself. I did graduate work at USC in philosophy, not in speech, and so I don't come to you today pretending to be an expert in communication or rhetoric or debate. But epistemology was my field, theory of knowledge, when I got my PhD. And as a Christian, that naturally leads to a consideration of the defense of the faith, what we call apologetics. And it's from that perspective that I'll be speaking to you. The 5th century before Christ saw the rise of a group of itinerant teachers in Greece, a group which included men like Protagoras and Hippias, Thrasymachus and Gorgias, and which came to be called the Sophist. And all of you who have done your historical work are nodding your head saying, oh yes, I remember them. The Sophist. Now the Greek term sophistes meant wise or skilled, and came to be originally applied to such men because they were skilled in rhetoric and debate, and they made their living teaching grammar, linguistic theory, and especially wisdom about man and his political environment. By the 2nd century before Christ, the word sophist had generally come to denote merely a teacher of rhetoric, a paid instructor who could help a young man learn to master and especially manipulate argumentation so as to persuade his political order or his social circle in a particular direction. In his dialogue entitled Sophist, Plato does not treat such teachers as genuine seekers after truth, but rather indicates a great disdain for the sophist as men who are concerned only with money and securing success in argumentation by any means whatsoever. I would take it that the sophist in Plato's day pretty much had the reputation of what a politician has in ours, a man who can get himself ahead and get his way. And Plato didn't like that. Above all, what the sophist represented was a bold attack on traditional ideas and the propounding of relativism, which in turn meant epistemological and moral skepticism. And at that point, Plato was stung philosophically and said there has to be a reaction. Common sophistic doctrines included the doctrine that we can know nothing but our sense impressions. We hear that today. We have some apologists today who tell us things like that, that all we can know is what our senses bring to us. Well, once you begin with that kind of theory of knowledge and learn something about the way a man's conceptualization affects what his senses tell him, then it's a very natural step to relativism, because the way I perceive the world is going to depend upon my social setting, upon my upbringing, upon my conceptual scheme, upon my personality, any number of other things that would not seem to have any necessary connection with the truth. So the sophists believed that men could know only their sense impressions, and of course the famous saying which is at the heart of humanism, the doctrine that man is the measure of all things. The standard by which everything is evaluated is man, and in particular the individual man. Another doctrine of theirs, there are no universal truths, no truth which holds in all societies at all times, or any truths about universals, and as well that truth is simply a matter of convention. Now, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, all in their own ways, reacted strongly against the absurdity of sophistic doctrine and the deplorable results it was bringing for man's knowledge and for man's society. Since those grand classical days of philosophical polemic, it has just naturally become the case that issues in speech, communication, rhetoric, or debate have been closely intertwined with fundamental questions in philosophy, and in particular, intertwined with the fundamental questions of epistemology, the theory of knowledge. And so I come to you, you know, bearing gifts. I would like to be at peace with you. You all study speech, I've studied philosophy, but historically these two have been intertwined. The doctrines upon which the masters of speech proceed are philosophical doctrines, and the doctrines that philosophers master are the doctrines which lead naturally out to theories of communication and debate, rhetoric, what have you. Now then, having tried to show you why I might talk to people in speech, the key question across the centuries in epistemology, and therefore an underlying issue throughout the centuries in the theory of speech, the key question has been whether any knowledge can count as certain. Can we be certain of anything? Bertrand Russell, who was perhaps the most prolific 20th century philosopher, opened his treatment of the book The Problems of Philosophy in 1912, that was the first edition of the book, with these words. He said, "Is there any knowledge in the world which is so certain that no reasonable man can doubt it? This question, which at first sight might not seem difficult, is really one of the most difficult that can be asked. When we have realized the obstacles in the way of a straightforward and confident answer, we shall be well launched on the study of philosophy, for philosophy is merely the attempt to answer such ultimate questions." And what is the most ultimate question in philosophy? The question, is there any knowledge in the world which is so certain that no reasonable man can doubt it? The theory of knowledge, epistemology, is a critical issue in philosophy. The philosophical scholar not only discusses what reality is and what moral obligations we have, but he must also ask, how do we know that these things are so? How do we know that reality is this? How do we know that we have this moral duty? One can no more avoid questions in the theory of knowledge in studying philosophy than a marine biologist can avoid the ocean. It's just the context in which we do philosophy. While it is certainly not the whole of philosophy, epistemology has, for better or for worse, dominated philosophy since the 17th century, and its crucial questions retain their intellectual challenge even today, which is something I want to convince you of before we are done. So, is there any knowledge in the world of which we can be certain? Can anything be known for sure? Can skepticism be answered? Such questions as these have been a key motivation in the development of epistemology. In 1934, the guiding spirit of the Vienna Circle, the modern analytic movement, comes out of the Vienna Circle. The founder of that movement wrote in the article The Foundation of Knowledge, "All important attempts at establishing a theory of knowledge grow out of the problem concerning the certainty of human knowledge. And this problem in turn originates in the wish for absolute certainty. The insight that the statements of daily life and science can at best be only probable has again and again stimulated philosophers since ancient times to search for an unshakable, indubitable foundation, a firm basis on which the uncertain structure of our knowledge could rest." And that is Morris Schlick speaking in 1934. And so the problem of epistemic certainty looms large in the theory of knowledge, and thereby has determinative significance for all of philosophy. Hamlin, in his recent text on epistemology, writes, "The search for indubitable and infallible truths is therefore a common feature of traditional epistemology." Perhaps if you could hand me the chalk there, I'll try to keep you abreast now of what we're doing. Okay, so epistemology is going to involve the search for certainty. And I'd like to telegraph here what we're going to end up seeing by the end of our hour. The search for certainty has led philosophers into various ways of answering that. How do we find certainty? Do we need certainty? Things of that nature. Now, Christian apologists have done two things. The vast majority have done the one, and I'm in the minority that does the other. Okay, so I admit the numerical minority, but I do maintain the philosophical superiority of this approach. The vast majority say, we let the secular world determine the standards for attaining epistemic certainty. And then we as Christians come along and we say, we can meet those standards, okay? So we pass the test, and therefore you can say Christianity is certain. Now, it doesn't take any sophistication in logic or epistemology to see that if that's your overall approach, even if you can get to the conclusion that Christianity is certain, and I don't think anybody has done that. I mean, there's a whole lot more in-house talking among Christians about the certainty of our faith than there is conviction outside. But even if you could get to that, you get to it at a very high price. Because Christianity becomes certain at the cost of what? Something being more certain than it. These standards set by the secular world. So whenever you have an apologetical system that argues, you tell me what the standards of truth or certainty are, and I'll meet those standards, and therefore you'll see Christianity is true. Even if you get to your conclusion, you have to grant to your opponent that there is something of higher epistemic authority that he or she has, those standards that have been delivered to you. Now, there's another fatal defect. It goes beyond that. If you use this approach to defending the faith, you also end up saying, and you don't need Christianity for your standards. Christianity becomes at best the conclusion of the system, not the heart of the system. You not only say that Christianity is less certain than those secular standards, you're saying those secular standards make sense on their own. This is what we call autonomy. Something is autonomous when it's independent, when it's self-sufficient, when it's a law to itself. That's what the Greek word autonomy means, a law to itself. So, if we prove Christianity is certain by this method, we do so at the cost of granting that secular standards are more certain and that secular standards are autonomous. And if I were an unbelieving philosopher, and I thank the Lord I'm not, but if I were an unbelieving philosopher and I realized these are the implications of the approach, I'd say, even if you've proven, say, the resurrection to me, I'd end up saying, well, as a matter of fact, I don't need Christianity because my standards are all right as far as they go. And consequently, Christianity is at best an appendix to my system of thought, my worldview. That's one approach. Another approach, from a Christian standpoint, is to say there can be no certainty regarding anything without Christianity. Okay, there can be no certainty about anything without Christianity. Now, on that approach, instead of taking one standard that somebody else gives you, showing that you passed that standard, and then concluding that Christianity is true, you say, we can take anything in the world that anybody claims to know. I know that that's my bicycle. I know that water quenches thirst. I know that murder is wrong. Anything that a person knows, and challenge them to show how they could possibly know it if the Christian worldview were not true. So you see, this is really a turning of the tables. We're saying there can be no standards without Christianity. There can be no absolute standards. Nothing can be known with certainty without the Christian worldview. That's a much bolder claim, and you can understand why people maybe shy away from it, because it would seem to lead to the conclusion that unbelievers don't know anything. But that isn't what it leads to at all. It leads to the conclusion that unbelievers can't account for what they know. They can still know things, but they can't give an account of what they know. As Dr. Van Til at Westminster Seminary used to say, unbelievers can count, but they can't account for counting. Okay, so unbelievers know plenty. I mean, the man who did my open heart surgery knew a lot about hearts. But you see, if my worldview were not true, he wouldn't have known anything about hearts, and he probably wouldn't have done as good a job as he did. But I'm here today, not because his worldview is right, but because my worldview is right. Even though he was doing the operation, it's only in terms of a Christian outlook on life that anything makes sense. Science, math, morals, human dignity, what have you. So, this is where I'm going to be going. Go ahead.
I just want to make sure you're going that way. I make sure that you were going to explain that a bit more.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to try to do here today, is talk about the search for certainty in terms of a Christian response to it. Now, there are many kinds of relativism. All of them, however, are best understood as reactions stimulated by advances in anthropology and the sociology of knowledge. advances which point to the diverse ways in which people see the truth. And you have to catch that. These advances in anthropology point out the diverse ways in which people see the world or see the truth. In his Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle observes, and I quote, "Fire burns both in Hellas and in Persia, but men's ideas of right and wrong vary from place to place." And that is a very pithy illustration of relativism. Fire burns everywhere you look. And yet, when you talk about morals, ideas of morals vary from place to place. There's clearly a difference between what happens when I learn about fire burning and when I talk about whether murder or adultery is wrong. The relativist has this going for him. I think we must grant this. I would do so. He recognizes the importance of social environment, conceptual scheme, and other sorts of things in determining the content of a person's beliefs. Secondly, the relativist notes the possibility of a great diversity in such environment, conceptual scheme, so forth. So there are things which affect a man's beliefs, his social upbringing, his conceptual scheme, his expectations. And there's a great diversity in social upbringing, conceptual scheme, expectation, and all the rest. So the relativist is certainly correct in noting all these things. The question, of course, is whether these accurate observations should lead us to infer that there are no universal or absolute truths. It's one thing to say there are all these things working on a person's belief system, and there's all this diversity of belief systems. And it's another thing to say, therefore, nothing is absolutely true. In fact, there is a tremendous philosophical gap between the true observation of subjective factors in knowledge to the conclusion that everything's subjective, everything's relative. I think I can illustrate the problem in relativism by beginning at the easy stage. Let me deal with ethical relativism for a moment, because we run into this all the time. Think of the maxim, this is a pretty good expression of relativism, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Okay? Inference is, when in Persia, do as the Persians do. It may be different, but get along with your society, okay? So when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Now, is that a specific and a categorical universal standard of conduct? When a person says, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, is he saying this is universally true? This is a specific categorical obligation we are under. Well, it's hard to see how it could be interpreted otherwise. It certainly does seem like, you know, advice to you to follow in all cases. Get along with the society in which you find yourself. But then you see a very great difficulty arises because the relativist has come around to stating the universal standard that there are no universal standards. Or to put it another way, just as much tongue-in-cheek, the relativist is absolute about his relativism. But you see, if I were a relativist, I should be relative about my relativism, not absolute about it. So when you say everything is relative, you must at least exclude the remark that everything is relative. So you can see that in morals, that's just as much true in epistemological or conceptual relativism. To be a relativist about fact is to maintain that there is no such thing as objective knowledge of realities independent of the knower. And so the parallel difficulty here is to avoid, if you hold that, to avoid the inconsistent claim that the relativistic thesis is itself an item of objective knowledge. Okay, so we have the learned professors of epistemology, maybe of speech, I don't know if you run into this as much as we do, but we have these people who say there is no absolute truth. And you notice I put that in quotes because that's also an item to be considered. Here are some other claims that people make in the world. Water is wet. Murder is wrong. This lecture is long. Okay? Now, is water wet? Somebody can say, well, that's relative, of course, depending on, you know, where you come from. Some people that live in watery environs might not observe the wetness of water as much as people who live in dry climates. And so the wetness of water is going to be relative to certain factors. Is murder wrong? Well, that's a real big one. And forgetting, of course, that murder is defined as that killing which is wrong. We might have said killing is wrong here. No, that's going to be debatable, isn't it? Not everybody agrees with that one. And as to the length of this lecture, some of you might have thought that it should have been over 5 minutes ago. Others are saying, oh, this is really getting good. Let's keep going. You know, so everything's relative, right? Whether the wetness of water or the wrongness of murder or the longness of this lecture. So the relative says, there's my point, there's my point, there's my point. And then I turn around and say, and here's another one we can relativize, right? There is no absolute truth. Since there is no absolute truth, this is not absolutely true, this is not absolutely true, this is not absolutely true, on and on and on and on. And by the way, of all the English sentences we can consider, here's another English sentence. That one can't be absolutely true either. So, there is no absolute truth is not absolutely true if there is no absolute truth. So you see the difficulty in epistemological relativism. It's kind of like the person who gets so hungry that he starts eating his toes and just can't stop, you know, just finally devours himself. Now, what are we going to do to escape epistemological relativism? Let me give you a quote or two here. I think I have time. Gordon Kaufman, in his book Relativism, Knowledge, and Faith, writes, that is, relativistic theories presuppose the very concept of objective validity, which they allegedly destroy. And without such presupposition, they lose all meaning. For if they do not themselves claim to be objectively valid and true, we have no reason for taking any of the statements in the theory seriously. But if they do make such claims, then it is evident that certain kinds of statements and theories, at least those of the relativist, must be exempt from determination by non-rational, non-logical, situational factors. And thus it is not true that all of man's knowledge and truth is relative. So the second thing we've done here, we've noted that there's a search for certainty in philosophy and indirectly in the various areas of speech and communication theory, but epistemological relativism, self-refuting, and so now we're back on the road. We've got to find certainty. How are we going to find certainty? In the history of Western philosophy, perhaps the most common way of trying to find certainty is what we call foundationalism. Foundationalism is a theory of knowledge that maintains, in order to be sure of our propositions, our premises, we need to make sure that they are based on foundations for knowledge, adequate or proper foundations for knowledge. Somewhere in these notes I have a statement to that effect. Foundationalism aims to obtain cognitive certainty beyond psychological assurance by anchoring one's beliefs in some kind of secure basis, certain unassailable propositions. And from that foundation, we can conduct intellectual inquiries according to strict and reliable methods of reasoning, admitting to our system of thought no proposition which is not certified by the foundation or by other foundationally certified beliefs, and thereby guaranteeing ourselves an accurate depiction of the world. Now, this approach to knowledge has enjoyed numerous devotees through history, Aristotle, Descartes, the logical positivists of the 20th century, and many more. Indeed, foundationalism might very well be considered the banner of the Western Enlightenment and its movement. You see, reason must be given a secure starting point so that knowledge may be gained in the absence of any form of cognitive imperialism. Now, what is cognitive imperialism? There are different forms of it. Arrogance, for instance. Here's the person who says, I know that it's true and I don't have to give an argument for it. Or dogmatism, the view that, well, God said it to me and I know that it's true. Or fideism, that, well, everybody has to start somewhere, and this is just where I begin. Critical skepticism is not answered by any of these approaches. And so the foundationalist wants to assure that not all convictions have an equal claim to acceptance. Not all convictions have an equal claim to acceptance. If you are a relativist, and that leads to skepticism, then it turns out a person saying, I believe that today is Friday, and a person who says, I believe the great pumpkin to come next October. These two propositions are on an equal epistemic footing. One is as rational or irrational as the other. And so foundationalists don't like that. I don't think any of us really do. Foundationalists in particular don't like that. And they say the way you distinguish between reason and unreason is by looking at propositions and seeing whether they're founded. Okay? So if I can relate the proposition about this being Friday to a secure foundation for knowledge, then it counts. But if the great pumpkin theory cannot be so related to the foundation, it doesn't count as knowledge. Can anybody tell me what the next question is going to become then if you're a foundationalist? What's the foundation? Right. It's one thing to say your theory of knowledge has that kind of anatomy or structure, that everything has to be related to foundations, but then what is the foundation going to be? Here are some possibilities. Common sense foundationalism. Common sense foundationalism can be found in the 20th century in the writings of G.E. Moore and Ludwig Wittgenstein, and to some degree in, I think, Norman Malcolm's book, Knowledge and Certainty. The position is that certain universal and compulsively held beliefs about readily observable public facts are basic and presupposed by all other beliefs. What kind of belief would that be? Here's one. There are other people. Okay, I believe there are other people. Now that would be considered a universal, compulsively held belief about a readily observable public fact, which is basic and presupposed by all my other beliefs. Now as the final courts of appeal in all inquiries and disputes, these common sense beliefs are logically, now notice that, they are logically beyond the possibility of correction. See, if I get down to my foundation, then there's nothing more foundational for the foundation, or else we're not really at the foundation. So logically, I can't correct such beliefs if they are in the foundation. However, such beliefs, we must recognize, offer a jeopardized and thus unsuccessful candidate for foundational beliefs. They do not provide infallible knowledge, but only what is called in philosophy incorrigible knowledge. As unavoidably imposed as common sense beliefs may be, there is no guarantee that things actually are as they seem to us to be. See, somebody might say, my belief that there are other people is incorrigible. That cannot be corrected. I could not give up that belief. But you see, that's a psychological fact, that I can't give up that belief. The fact that I can't give it up doesn't tell me anything about the world. A person who is suffering DTs can't give up his belief that there are snakes on the bed either. It's incorrigible for him. He sees them. That doesn't mean there are snakes on the bed. In addition to this phenomenological weakness, this version of foundationalism suffers great embarrassment by the faulty and conflicting ways in which common sense beliefs are identified and enumerated by people. That is to say, if you were to go through the university this afternoon and just take any random 100 people, say, tell me what your common sense beliefs are, the ones that you just can't give up, it's going to be interesting to see the great diversity and in some cases conflict between these allegedly common sense beliefs. They're not so commonsensical after all. And so then we look at another possibility, which is, I think, a very big one in Christian apologetical circles today. Perceptual foundationalism maintains that infallible basic propositions which transcend beliefs imposed on us and which give an objective depiction of things are found in sincere first-person present-tense reports of a perceptual experience. I now seem to be seeing a yellow pencil. Okay? So there's a first-person present-tense perceptual experience reported. First-person, present-tense reports of a perceptual experience. I now seem to be seeing a yellow pencil. Okay? So there's a first person, present tense, perceptual experience reported. Those who hold this view find the absence of any mediating agency between the knowing person and the private psychological state of which he is aware a guarantee that misinterpretation is precluded and one cannot be misled. That is to say, the strength of a perceptual foundation is its non-inferential character. I'm not drawing any inference when I say I see white chalk, or so it's said. I'm not sure that I hold to that view, but that is the claim. The weakness of depending upon these allegedly non-inferential certitudes, however, is far more compelling to me. Let me tell you a few of these weaknesses. Perceptual foundations for knowledge are not universal, because some people don't have perceptions, right? There are some people that are blind, for instance. And even forgetting that, not every use of perception turns out to be veridical. Even people who can see are subject to optical illusions. And our perceptions are not defeasible by reference, for instance, to a normal perceiver under normal circumstances. That if somebody says, oh, wait a minute. What I mean is, perceptions are foundational when a normal perceiver under normal circumstances sees things. But then you see what you have to go back and do is define what a normal perceiver is and what normal circumstances are. And you have to be able to determine that you are a normal perceiver in such normal circumstances. But what is it that makes circumstances abnormal? Anybody tell me how many factors are there that affect the normality of our perceptions? Does anybody in the room know? I don't know. I don't think any epistemologist knows. The more we learn about the use of the human eye, the more we learn about psychology, we learn all the time all these factors. For me to say for sure I am a normal perceiver in normal circumstances, I have to be able to check off all the invalidating circumstances and say none of them apply to me. So now I am, in fact, seeing white chalk. Now, do I know right now that I'm not dreaming this lecture? I mean, I had to prepare the lecture. Maybe it's really Thursday night, and I'm dreaming that I'm giving this lecture and perceiving the chalk. Now, there are ways to check that, right? Okay, let's say I've checked that one, and I can get rid of it. But now, how many other factors might there be? Maybe something I ate for lunch has affected my field of vision, and on and on and on and on and on. Perceptual foundations just aren't the sorts of things that qualify as foundations, even if you do generally trust your senses. And then the problems of delusion and illusion preclude our having certainty that some external object, which is appearing to us in the way that we are perceiving, is in fact external. Okay, if I were to have everybody stare at this light, actually they're not very bright in this room, but I think it would still work with these. Anyway, imagine a much brighter light. You stare at that light for 30 seconds. Don't look away, stare at the light. And then we turn off the lights. And you know what? You're going to see a red afterglow. Does that mean that there's something red up there in the ceiling? No, that means there's something going on in the chemistry of your eyeball and brain where you have the impression. Is that so? It goes to show that our perceptions are not always veridical anyway. Oh, and I have a whole bunch of other things here that would probably be too complicated.
Descartes, I think, therefore.
No, not really. Descartes would be closer to a common sense foundationalism, where he'd say you can't. I can't deny that I'm doubting, because if I deny that I'm doubting, then it's I who deny that I am doubting, and so there's always the I there. Of course, Bertrand Russell had the classic answer to Descartes. Descartes said, I doubt, therefore I am. Okay? Bertrand Russell says the conclusion doesn't follow from the premise. I doubt, therefore there's doubting going on, is the conclusion. That doesn't prove that I exist. It just proves that somewhere in the universe there's doubting. Now, let's go on to prove that it's myself, that there's a personal, individual mind doing the doubting. So, this goes to show you, what can we be sure of, right? I think that's what the lecture's about today. What can we be certain of? Of course, to speak counterfactually, even if pure and infallible perceptual foundations could be acquired, what would be the secure or reliable method of reasoning by which we could build a system of thought outward from the foundations? Assume, again, contrary to everything I've told you, that we can get perceptual foundations, okay? This is a foundation. One perception, this is white chalk. You're going to be able to live with that one foundation? I mean, not a whole lot to base a life on. Most people are going to want to take a few of these foundational perceptions and build a system outward, right? Until you get something a little more interesting, you know, like I love you. That would be nice to get from this is white chalk to I love you someday. And other things in between, like what is justice and what is man and all the other key things that keep Western culture going. How do I move from this is white chalk and that is white chalk to other more important premises? Somebody says, well, we use deduction, right? But deduction will not allow us to accept the most elementary universal propositions about physical objects based on the simple basis of particular perceptions. For you see, if I'm going to use deduction, you all know the standard illustration of deduction, don't you? All men are mortal. Aren't we tired of this? All men. None of us are giving up our manhood or mortality, but we're tired of it anyway. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, class, that's right, Socrates is mortal. Now, in order to do this one simple transaction in deduction, though, I have to know what? That all men are mortal. Now, how would I know that all men are mortal? I say, well, I've seen a man die. And you say, yeah, well, so one man died. Oh, I've seen 10 men die. I've seen 100 die. I've seen 1,000 men die. Does that mean that all men are mortal? You see, we're being tied down to the foundation of our perceptions. I don't for a moment doubt that all men are mortal. But when somebody says, I'm a perceptual foundationalist, I say, well, have you perceived that all men are mortal? Now, what if everybody in the whole world died except for that one man who was the perceptual foundationalist? Could he then say all men are mortal? No, he couldn't say all men are mortal until what? Until he died. But then, you see, he wouldn't be there to say it. And so, you have problems with perceptual foundationalism because deduction is not possible. And somebody says, okay, we won't use deduction, we'll use induction, what's called probabilistic reasoning. All right? Every crow that I've seen so far is black. And therefore, very probably, the next crow that I see will be black. That's probabilism, or what's called inductive reasoning. The difficulty is, of course, that probabilism or inductive reasoning can show neither that its required assumption is known with certainty, nor that it is even probably true. What is the required assumption of probabilism? The required assumption is that there's uniformity in experience and nature. Because if there is no uniformity in the world, then it doesn't make any sense to extrapolate from past instances to future instances. Past crows have been black, the next crow, the future crow, will be black as well. That doesn't make a bit of sense, unless nature is uniform. Now, if you're a perceptual foundationalist, how can you know that all of nature is uniform? So the foundation of induction, and therefore of science, has been lost as well. Foundationalism is basically on the ropes today in 20th century epistemology. Those people who think you find certainty by relating your proposition to a secure foundation have not been able to carry out the task, and you have a lot of people moving back in the direction of epistemological relativism. However, another approach that has been attempted in the 20th century, and I'll be much more brief with this, is pragmatism. Pragmatism says that we know something is certain. Well, to be literally honest with you, most pragmatists say we don't care about certainty. Certainty is just an intellectual game that's been played in the history of Western philosophy. We don't need what's called epistemological certainty. All we need is success. We need success in building theories that will help us control our environment or achieve the goals that we set for ourselves. So that if you have, let's say we have epistemological theories X, Y, and Z, and it turns out that only theory Y leads to success in what I want to do, if that's the only one that will give me success, or if it leads to more success than Z or X do, relatively speaking, that we prefer theory Y, or methodology Y, as it would be called for a pragmatist. So we give up the traditional questions of epistemology. What is truth? What is certainty? How do we know? We give up those questions in favor of questions, how are we going to get along best in the world? What method is going to gain for us the things we want to gain? Now, to avoid arbitrariness and question begging, however, an external justification becomes necessary, forcing the pragmatist to go outside of epistemology and what is called naturalize his procedures, to reduce epistemology to another branch of science. And this justification must be descriptive in nature, claiming that a given agent succeeds in getting to his given goals if he adheres to a given system or method. And there is a number of possibilities. There are those who say we should naturalize epistemology to psychology. Others say we should naturalize it to biology. Still others say we ought to naturalize it to sociology. Some say we should naturalize it to anthropology. Now the trouble with all of these naturalizing epistemologies, all these pragmatic approaches, which reduce to one branch of descriptive science or another, is that they answer the request for a justification of science by skirting the question. Epistemology is a normative endeavor. It's not simply a descriptive enterprise that says this agent using this method will achieve that goal. The quest for justification is an evaluative quest, just because the alternative goals need to be apprised as to their respective values. You see, if you tell me use that method which gives you the best success in accomplishing your goals, then the question becomes, well, which goals should I have? Should they be anthropological, biological, psychological, aesthetic? What are the proper goals in life? The pragmatist forces us to know what the meaning of man and the world and life is, and yet, if anything, that is a theory that tells us all of those are vain questions. And so the pragmatist ends up without justification for knowledge either. And now it's getting late in the hour and you're saying, what are we going to do? Nobody has any answers. Look, we have to have certainty, relativism self-refuting, foundationalism's in disrepute, pragmatism skirts the issue, what's left? Well, if I can be so humble, I want to offer an alternative. I want to offer Christian transcendentalism as an answer. Now I'm going to have to explain what transcendentalism is for you. It's not a theory of life propounded by Emerson and Thoreau and some of these fellows in the 19th century. Transcendentalism is a theory of knowledge and life that refers to the transcendentals of knowledge, the transcendentals. I'm going to give you another word for transcendentals here. A transcendental is a precondition. And according to transcendentalists throughout history, Christian and non-Christian, there are what we call preconditions of knowledge. Certain things must be satisfied before knowledge would become possible. For instance, scientific knowledge takes as one of its preconditions the uniformity of nature. Right? So, also, logical knowledge takes as its precondition the absoluteness of logical laws. That's an interesting thing. According to logic, there must be absolute, unchanging laws. According to science, there must be non-absolute or contingent, changing particulars. I could go on and talk about ethics and anthropology and other fields too, but there are certain preconditions, you see, to do science or logic or psychology or anthropology or what have you. The Christian says, the Christian who is a transcendentalist, or what might be called a presuppositionalist, says that only Christianity provides the preconditions for knowledge. Only Christianity provides the preconditions for knowledge. Somebody at that point might say, well, wait a minute. Why doesn't a person who is not a Christian, an unbeliever, just say, well, my view of the world is there are absolute unchanging laws. That the most fundamental thing you can say about the world is that it's law-like. Everything happens according to law-like explanations. And then I'd say, okay, that's fine, so he saves logic. Now, but if everything is absolute and unchanging and law-like, what happens to contingent changing particulars? Apparently there's no such thing as history or freedom or humanity or science. And then he says, okay, wait a minute. I didn't mean it was absolute and unchanging and law-like. No. The universe is really radically contingent and individual. I really believe that the world is contingent and changing and full of particulars. You say, okay, that's great. You save science, but then there goes logic. You don't have any absolute unchanging laws if you only have contingent particulars. Now, you can get an unbeliever then running back and forth, and again, we could add other things here like ethics, trying to do his best to bring all this together. But it turns out, I believe, that no other worldview offers the preconditions of science, logic, morality, and all the rest. Now, if that is correct, and I can't be expected in 1 hour, I know you wouldn't expect me in 1 hour to be able to offer a thorough defense of the Christian faith, but I'm talking about the structure of our defense. If we take a transcendental approach to the defense of Christianity, we end up defending not just the truth of Christianity, but what? The truth of science, the truth of logic, the truth of morals. And that's what we were interested in, searching for certainty. Now, I have a quote I want to give you, which is not by a Christian, it's by a secular epistemologist, but I think he has it right when he says, this is Harry Frankfurt, by the way, he says, the claim that a basis for doubt is inconceivable is justified whenever a denial of the claim would violate the conditions or presuppositions of rational inquiry. I'll say that again. The claim that a basis for doubt is inconceivable is justified whenever a denial of the claim would violate the conditions or presuppositions of rational inquiry. Okay, we're looking for certainty. Somebody comes along and says, I think certainty is found in my perceptions, and then you know all the arguments against that. Somebody says, I think certainty is found in common sense beliefs, and you know the arguments against that. Somebody says, I don't think we need certainty, we just need pragmatic success, you know the arguments against that. But now somebody comes along and he says, I think what is certain is what the Bible teaches. Okay, and after everybody gets done laughing and saying, oh, you throw back, and you believe possibly the Bible, ha ha ha, and all that, you say, okay. But now, if I start with that worldview, you'll notice that I can, first of all, defend the dignity of man. Because man's made in the image of God. It isn't right to murder people. You know, rape and kidnapping and thievery and all the rest, you see, are wrong. And these are the sorts of things that you want to defend on a moral side. You see, we have a way of doing that. Not only that, I can defend the progress of science. I can defend the possibility of science. I can defend the uniformity of nature. I can defend the absoluteness of logic. On and on and on. So you may laugh, but after all, I've got a worldview here that stands up. Okay, so we have at least one contender. We have one worldview in terms of the biblical presuppositions that can make science and make sense out of all these other things, can offer the preconditions of rational inquiry. Now, Frankfurt tells us the claim that a basis for doubt is inconceivable is justified whenever a denial of the claim violates the preconditions of rational inquiry. I'm saying I think that the Bible is wrong is inconceivable. I think the Bible is indubitable. I think it's infallible. Now, does that mean somebody should believe it just because I say it? Am I saying the Bible claims to be infallible, therefore it is infallible? No. I'm saying the Bible is infallible, and when you deny it, you haven't got any other foundation for knowledge. Now, you can try, and obviously the history of man has shown his many attempts to get a foundation for knowledge apart from submitting to the living and true God. But what does Proverbs say? Proverbs says the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. respect for your Maker, reverence before the Word of God. That's the beginning. In Hebrew, it is the rosh of knowledge. It is the head of knowledge. It is the first point of knowledge. And the book of Proverbs goes on to say that those who do not love me hate knowledge and wisdom. They destroy it. When Paul talks about the Christian faith in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he tells Timothy to defend the faith against those claims of pseudo-knowledge. Pseudo-knowledge. Yes, unbelievers know things, but it's pseudo-knowledge because it can't account for what is known. It denies the preconditions of rationality. And so when I claim that the search for certainty is satisfied in Christianity, I'm saying that those who deny the Christian worldview have denied the presuppositions of rational inquiry. Now, what I told you before, we can come back to. There are two approaches to defending the faith. One approach says, let's be foundationalist, and our foundations are going to be scientific truths, or historical truths, or something. And since those are our standards, now what we have to do as Christians is to show that Christianity passes the test summa cum laude, okay? You're a historicist, and now I'm going to go to you and say, now look, Jesus rose from the dead, here's all this evidence. Or if you're a scientist, I'm going to show you that evolution's not true. Or if whatever it may be, I take my standards from somebody else, okay? Here are these standards supplied by, say, a secular or autonomous world, and I say Christianity passes. That's one approach. The pragmatist says, I'm a Christian because it works. And I think what is supposed to work in life is you're getting along with your wife and being sure that you're going to go to heaven when you die. And that happens when I'm a Christian. And somebody else says, well, you know, I'm not too interested in getting along with my wife. I'm not even going to get married. And I don't even think there is an afterlife. And so what does a pragmatist say to that? He goes, well, but it works for me. You see, and that reduces to relativism. So that approach to Christianity is not going to help. What you have left is saying that there are no standards. No standards are possible without Christianity. It is the sine qua non of knowledge. Interestingly, in Matthew, the 7th chapter, Jesus, our Lord, teaches a story which I guess every Sunday school child learns in musical form about the wise man who builds his house upon the rock and the foolish man who builds his house upon the sand. We all know that story. We forget sometimes that Jesus, when he concluded the parable, says, and my word is the rock. Those who are wise build their lives, their outlook, their perspectives, their worldviews on the rock of Jesus' word. And those who don't build their lives on his word are fools. Is it any surprise, therefore, that in 1 Corinthians 1, when Paul goes over his apologetic, he says, where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For in its own wisdom it rejects what it takes to be foolish, the preaching of the cross. But Paul says we know that that's the wisdom of God. So there are worldviews in collision. That's the situation right now. There is the secular worldview, the naturalistic worldview, the existentialist worldview, the relativist worldview, any number of options, and they stand over against the Christian worldview. How do you defend the Christian worldview? I suggest you defend it by saying you can't know anything for sure unless Christianity is true. Or if I've kind of lost you for all this lecture, I'm going to put it in one sentence, okay? In this one sentence, at least, you can leave understanding, I'm sure. The best proof of the Christian God's existence is that without him you can't prove anything. The best proof of the Christian God's existence is that without him you can't prove anything. That's just the real pointed way of saying that the Christian worldview is indubitable because it provides the preconditions of knowledge. And that I take to be the certainty of the Christian faith. You've been very good to let me go so long. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk now and either combat this idea or clarify it or ask questions or whatever.